Thank you for downloading this podcast from the UK Intensive Care Society State of the Art Meeting 2015. It's even better in person, so put December the 5th to the 7th, 2016 in your diary and come and join us in London next year.
Out in late December, along with some Canadian doctors and nurses, out to Sierra Leone to start work. Sierra Leone's incredibly poor. You really can't imagine it if you've not been there or not been to another developing country. The gross domestic product in Sierra Leone is $1.25 a day. There's no municipal sanitation, waste collection, anything like that. And that's obviously the real reason that people got Ebola. It wasn't because they were eating bush meat and so on. It's because the place is just so desperately poor and there's no health infrastructure. We set up a treatment centre at Kerrytown, and by the time I got out there it was up and running and had been open for about a month. Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone, is a pretty big city with about 2 million people. We were about 40 minutes south of it, near one of the main road junctions in an area where there would potentially be a lot of patients. And our treatment centre was purpose-built, carved out of virgin jungle, and you can see the scale of it. It's a pretty big place. 80 beds were run by the Save the Children organisation, let's go the right way around, along here in large warehouses. And the MOD centre was along here with potentially 36 beds for treating healthcare workers. And the way an Ebola treatment centre works is it's basically there's only one way in and one way out, well, maybe two ways out. Patients come into an assessment area. And all of the areas where patients are cared for are in the red zone, where you have to wear PPE to go in there. So the patients come into an assessment area, and if they've got a fever or various other symptoms that fulfill the case criteria for Ebola, so things like myalgia, malaise, diarrhea and vomiting, they come into the suspected area. And our suspected area had four beds separated off by partitions so that patients couldn't interact. One of the criticisms of other Ebola treatment centres is that they would pool their suspected patients together in an area while they were waiting for their blood tests with a very high risk of cross-infection. And there's a strong likelihood that some of the Ebola treatment centres early on in the epidemic were cross-infecting patients. So patients wouldn't have Ebola, they'd have malaria, they'd go home, and then a few days later would develop the symptoms of Ebola. If a patient had a positive PCR, they'd then be moved into one of our confirmed beds. And then if they recovered, they would come out through a decontamination lane, have a shower, be given clean clothes, and given some money by the Sierra Leone government, discharged. If they died, they'd go out through the mortuary and be collected by a safe and dignified burial team. We took 10 days to acclimatise before we started work, and we got extra training in PPE. So our total training time in PPE was something like 24 days before we put hands on a patient. The PPE that's used by most organisations in the Ebola outbreak used very hot Tyvek suits, which are made of a moisture-impermeable fabric, wearing goggles, hoods and masks. We used a different PPE system. It was designed by experts at Defence Science and Technology Laboratories, Public Health England and various other organisations. And we used PPE that used a moisture-vapour permeable suit, a bit like Gore-Tex, which was a bit thinner than the Tyvek suits and not quite as hot. And rather than wearing hoods and goggles, we used visors, which means that you look a bit more human and a bit less frightening. We had disposable aprons, two pairs of gloves, one pair under the suit and one pair over, that are changed between patients to reduce the risk of healthcare infection. The team that we had on my rotation had three intensivists, an emergency physician in charge, various infectious disease specialists and some Canadian GPs and a gastroenterologist. The Canadian GPs are emergency medicine trained as well to some extent, so they're very, very useful people to have. Limited logistics, this is the sum total of everything we could get in the warehouse that you can see there. Very limited number of bits of kit. The military logistic chain is very good, but we only used that to start with and then we relied on the Department for International Development. Most of the patients we saw didn't have Ebola. They had things like diarrhea, malaria, flu. And we had a big advantage in that we had PCR pouch diagnostics. So you could take a nasal swab from someone, put it in a machine, and an hour later it would tell you if they had one of 16 different respiratory pathogens. Any patients who came in with a fever and for example, doctors who'd been working in Ebola treatment centres who came in with a fever would have to stay until they'd had a 72-hour negative Ebola test. So if they'd had symptoms for one day, they'd be in the Ebola treatment centre in the suspected area for 2 or 3 days until they'd reached that 72-hour point. We looked after lots of patients with Ebola. When I say lots, there were about 60 patients in total, with about 50% mortality. Ebola has a fairly stereotypical course. The incubation period's between about 2 and 21 days, but usually around 8 days, and then patients tend to get a fever, and then within 2 to 4 days of fever, they'll get severe diarrhea and vomiting. And because of the stigma associated with Ebola, many of our patients were presenting very late with established renal failure or multi-organ failure. Ebola care is protocolized, so you give patients oral rehydration therapy, you give them antibiotics, you give them anti-helminthics. We stopped giving antibiotics to everyone when they first came in because we recognized actually they don't all have a bacterial infection. A lot of them have got fever just due to Ebola. So the protocols that we used to start with are probably not quite right. The interventions that we did use are what I'd call limited critical care. We're able to put central lines in. Patients are coagulopathic, they're very oozy. Most of them, it was fairly minor and could be controlled with pressure dressings, but there were one or two patients who needed blood transfusion to deal with the amount of bleeding from their central line sites. But using central lines means that we reduced the number of venipunctures that we needed to do for things like potassium monitoring. Amazingly, a lot of Ebola treatment centers to start with didn't have any or had limited capacity to measure people's electrolytes. So some of these centers would have a £1 million PCR lab on site, but not have a £2,000 ISTAT machine to measure electrolytes. So we were able to measure electrolytes as often as we wanted. We could do point of care malaria testing. We had blood culture systems in our laboratory. And we had a big transfusion lab with the ability to give cross-matched blood and blood products. The other critical care intervention that we used was the FlexiSeal or similar fecal management devices, which contain the highly infectious diarrhea. And although most of our patients were awake, once they started having proper diarrhea, they'd usually ask to have a FlexiSeal put in just because of the awfulness of their diarrhea. It's an ISTAT. Note the potassium. We were fairly aggressively replacing potassium intravenously. And interestingly, we didn't see any patients who had sudden death. And if you watch documentaries about Ebola, a lot of the centers seem to have people who just be found dead. And we think that's probably due to hypokalemia, not pulmonary embolism or other things, although it's difficult to be certain because there weren't any facilities to do autopsies. We didn't have any feed, and the patients were awake, and many of them were confused and probably wouldn't have kept nasogastric tubes down. But we used things like Plumpy Nut, which is a ready-to-use therapeutic food that's got a very good evidence base for use in pediatrics. Some of the patients really liked it, some of them didn't. I haven't got lab results for all of our patients, but this is a very typical one from a young patient who stayed with us for 3 weeks and presented to us when he first became febrile and had a positive test for Ebola. I'm afraid the units are, the creatinine is American, but essentially 8 days into his illness, despite having quite a lot of intravenous fluid, he developed renal failure. And the suggestion is it wasn't just due to dehydration, that it was some direct effect of Ebola on the kidney. And his fluid replacement was it's not really heroic. The first few days he got 6 to 10 liters of fluid, and then after that, into his recovery phase, he was only getting a couple of liters a day intravenously. This is another patient, a lady in her 50s, who's a community nurse, who had a mild case of Ebola, and we saw a few mild cases of Ebola. She only needed about 2 liters of fluid a day and was better by about day 8, day 9. Not meant to put slides up and apologize for them, but this is the worst slide in the world. Essentially, the gray bars are the total amount of potassium in millimoles that individual patients got. And some of them got very little intravenous potassium, perhaps because they had died earlier on. Some patients got quite large amounts of potassium, particularly in the ones who stayed for a longer time. But the average amount of potassium required was about 200 millimoles over the course of the patient's length of stay, so not a vast amount. Ward round carried out in air-conditioned tents. Air conditioning doesn't work very well when it's 35 degrees, hot sun, and 80% humidity. And the patients often would ask just to have the tent flaps rolled up and let the air flow through. You can imagine the stresses of working in this kind of PPE in that kind of heat. The environment's very unforgiving on equipment. This is one of our ultrasound machines. It was a cordless ultrasound machine with rechargeable batteries, and the chlorine vapor corroded the copper contacts. It also corroded taps, sinks, ISTAT machines, and other bits of kit. The global inequity of Ebola is very obvious from this slide, which is all of the international workers being flown back to various parts of the world. I found that very difficult. Most of the people that we met, though, were proper humanitarians. This is a US nurse being evacuated after a needle stick injury. The process is amazing. He was given a vaccine trial days before he's put on a plane. He's put on a private Learjet and flown back to one of the centers in the US. The good things about the Ebola outbreak, I met people from home. And of course, it's the people you'd expect to meet, the people, you know, the best registrar in our hospital, people like that. So guys that we trained at the Army Medical Services Training Center, so people from Holland, Norway, and the UK, and some of my colleagues from back home working out there on, you know, for purely humanitarian reasons rather than self-aggrandizement. Even going in to do a very minor intervention in the Ebola Treatment Center meant a prolonged process of putting on your personal protective equipment. We use a supervised doffing process with an infection control nurse watching us put the kit on and checking it, and then a supervised decontamination process using buddy decon. And a lot of organizations don't trust anyone else to take their kit off, they'll only do it themselves. Our system, you trust your buddy, and you've also got a guy at the front, a PPE monitor, watching you like a hawk to make sure you don't make any mistakes. You can see the multiple hand-washing steps, and then things that are close to your face, like your goggles and mask, coming off very late on after you've decontaminated yourself. By the end of even the short period of time in the Ebola Treatment Center, you'd be literally wringing wet. We weighed ourselves before we went in and when we came out. We'd lose a kilogram in weight in 40 minutes. And putting a central line in with an additional sterile gown and gloves on top was just horrendous. You'd have literally have rivulets of sweat running down your mask and trying to stop them getting into the sterile field. At the end of my tour, I felt I'd achieved something. I'm sure that a lot of the patients that we treated would have died if they'd been treated elsewhere. But there was also an immense frustration that people were being referred to us so late that we knew they were going to die as soon as we'd see their laboratory results. They'd walk in, you'd do an ISTAT, their creatinine's 1,200, and you know that without dialysis, without ventilation, they're pretty much certain to die. We still try and treat them, but many patients ended up being palliated after they'd gone into a coma with irreversible renal failure. Our units and those run in Liberia and Guinea all ran below capacity, because by the time the UK and the other countries ramped up the response, it actually made a difference very, very quickly. On return, 21 days of more or less quarantine, temperature monitoring, phoning Public Health Scotland, in my case, every day, which is quite a painful process. And I didn't go home. I went and stayed in the Highlands with my parents because one of my colleagues had got norovirus and been taken away by men in white suits. This is all obviously the effort of a very large team. This is our team of doctors, including our NGP, because if you go to West Africa, you're going to get ill. More than half of us got gastroenteritis. Other people, some of our administrators got malaria. We had people working alongside us. We had one guy who died of malaria, one of the Cuban nurses. So it's quite a difficult environment to practice in, and you can't do it without having a formal kind of real-life support system to look after you and your colleagues. Most importantly, the reason we were there, this is one of our patients who survived. He was in the Ebola Treatment Center for more than 21 days. He's a student nurse. He had a prolonged period of convalescence, but then went back to work. And one of my colleagues who's been back in Sierra Leone has seen him back finishing his studies. And it's not quite over yet. This is one of the good things about working with DFID, that they didn't just look at the initial plan. They said that as part of the response, we'll build lots of clinics around Sierra Leone and train healthcare workers to improve the resilience of the country in case they have any further outbreaks. And I got back a week ago from Sierra Leone, where we put up a rapidly deployable isolation and treatment facility, which is basically a 16-bedded mobile Ebola treatment center run by the Sierra Leone Army and the Ministry of Health. The nurses and doctors from the Army and Ministry of Health have treated hundreds and hundreds of Ebola patients and are pretty good at it. They've got this mobile resilience unit that can go out at 3 days' notice anywhere in Sierra Leone and isolate and treat any patients that have Ebola if they get any more cases. I shall stop at that point.